So when I hand over, start fucking.
Hello.
Wait.
How does that go?
Please get the fuck up out of the way early.
Listen.
Oh, fuck, I set on the dog's goal.
From the burning mesas of the Arizona desert to the slot machine cardboard forks of New Jersey, it's the Imaginarium with Scott and Todd. I'm Scott Colbert.
And I am the horror nerd, Todd Staruch.
And this has happened to me before, and I know I've talked about it on the show a couple times in the past, but it's been a long time since it happened, and my internet went out. Well, the Wi-Fi, I don't pay for internet where I'm at. It's included in my rent. And for what they charge, it should be included in my rent. And I should be getting a blowjob every month from one of the hookers that lives here for the amount they charge. But it went out about 8:30 at night, and it didn't come back on until maybe 11-ish the next morning. And you just don't realize how much you actually depend on being online anymore until you're not. And all you have is your cellular data plan on your phone. And yes, I just had cataract surgery a few weeks ago. I'm getting my other eye done next week. But even still, I'm 58. My eyes you just don't see as well. And even on a 6-inch screen, 6 inches isn't as big as people need you to believe. I'm just leaving that there so people can ponder what I mean. It's a pain in the ass, and I'm doing something on my phone, and then I go to do something subconsciously, to go on my computer and realize, I can't do that because I don't have fucking internet. And I have hotspot capability with my phone, but I'm not paying an extra $10 a month for it.
So, I don't blame you.
Yeah. But I was very close the following morning. And it's disturbing to me how much I rely on it and not even think about the reliance that I have about it. It's simple stuff, checking my bank or, whatever, looking at my email or literally anything that I do anymore, has some kind of an online connection. Even ordering a Lyft, I use my phone for it,
Sure.
Checking the bus to see how late it's going to be this morning. I use my phone for I almost forget what it was like before we had the internet.
I completely get it. And this is why I kind of agree. There's been, and I don't know what the status of it is now, or if there's a bill or anything, but there has been a growing push to have the internet declared a public utility, just like electric and gas or oil or whatever, because of our reliance on it. Where it really came to head, I'm not a big fan of the word privilege, but sometimes it is accurate. During COVID, right, my daughter, when she was in Virginia, was living in a fairly rural area, not terrible, but fairly rural. So they, when everything went online, education-wise, like 50% of the kids in her district did not have broadband internet access. And you wonder, well, how can that be? And it's more widespread than you think across this country, So everybody was like, what are those kids going to do? Now, to their credit, and, I'm not a shill for big companies or anything, Verizon came through and donated like 1,000 mobile hotspots or something like that, you know?
Oh, wow. Nice.
They handed out, you know, because yeah, it's easy to say, oh, well, all kids are just remote, you know, learning, not without internet.
you know? And you know, the expense to do that, you know, to lay the cable for cable internet or, and satellite internet is outrageously priced, and you still have monthly caps on how much you can use, you know, how much data you can use. And that's fucking ridiculous in this day and age. And even when I had Cox at my last apartment and I was paying for it, it was still like 1.2 terabytes I had a month. Now, granted, I didn't use that. I think the most I ever used is 600 or 700 gigs a month. Because, you know, porn is a lot of
Listen, that's a lot of bandwidth, especially in high def.
Yeah, you know.
You're 100% right. We take it for granted. And this is how ignorant some people are. You know, I forget where I was. I don't remember. And I brought up the whole school thing and internet, and someone goes, yeah, but you know what? High speed internet is only like $40 or $50 a month. And I'm like, you say that as a person who can afford an extra $50 a month on internet. There are a lot of people who can't, you know, that's $50 less in food or medicine or whatever.
Or gas, you know.
Right, anything, you know, anything.
Because in those rural areas, I'm sure they don't have a whole lot of public transportation.
Not at all. Not when it's very, like, agricultural and the houses are far apart, you know. No, you're 100% right. You know, there's not a lot of public transport. But anyway, we can bitch about capitalism some other time.
Yeah, there is a lot to get to. And yes, as always seems to happen, whenever we miss a week or two of recording, everybody fucking dies.
I know. Now, where do you want to start?
Let's start with Pee Wee Herman, because he's the only one I remember. I know others have died, but
it really just happened a couple of days ago as we record this.
Yes, exactly. So that's why I remember it. And I know there are some others who died, but for the life of me, I can't remember who they were now.
I got them.
All right, good. I'm glad you did your research. Yeah.
Not really. I just Googled celebrity deaths 2023, and here they are.
Well, yeah, but that's still research, however.
True. Fair enough. Fair enough.
Right, and now, we talk when we have celebrity deaths. People talk about how it's shock and they weren't expecting it. And like, well, you know, they were 103 years old. You know, it was time. They were long overdue. But Pee Wee Herman, well, he was 70, so not like he was a spring chicken.
Right.
But it was just one of those you didn't expect. So that, I can say that I was shocked by Pee Wee Herman's death.
Me too.
So I certainly didn't expect it. And you know, it's not even like I was a huge Pee Wee Herman fan, because I wasn't. I found a little of his character went a very long way. I saw the first Pee Wee movie and I enjoyed it, but by the end of it, you just want to strangle him. I did like the Pee Wee's Playhouse, because that was like the perfect length for that character, 23, 24 minutes.
Yep.
And that's about as much as you can take of Pee Wee Herman's character before, you know, thoughts of homicide crush your skull. But, you know, he did more than that. I mean, he played, what was it, Batman's father in the original Tim Burton Batman movie?
No, not Batman's father. It was Penguin. Penguin's
father. Yeah.
Oswald Cobblepot, yep.
Yeah, and so he's done other things, but he's always going to be known. Well, one, he's always going to be known for Pee Wee's Playhouse. And he's always going to be known for playing with his peewee in a movie house.
Yeah, you know, that always bothered me. The law is the law. I get that. But something never sat right with me about that. First of all, that's what those places are for. It's not like he whipped his dick out on a playground or at the salad bar at the freaking diner. You know what I mean? And yeah. Not to mention, really, there were three cops in an adult movie theater just waiting to bust someone for jerking off. I mean, yeah, come on. Like, and if it was anybody else, nobody would have cared. They probably would have just said to the guy, hey, put it away and get the fuck out of here. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. But, yeah.
So, you know, I always felt he got a raw deal. Again, people will say, yeah, but technically he broke the law. I get that. But I still say it was like much ado about nothing. You know?
Yeah. It's like taking a pen from work. I mean, technically, you're stealing something from your job. But, you know, you don't have three cops, you know, waiting around your desk until you do something.
Right. Yeah, that whole thing just drove me crazy, you know, with that. But, yeah, I mean, you know, the thing about the fact that we were shocked at his death just goes to show, and I had a conversation with some friends about this, it just goes to show that even a public figure, when they're sick, can manage to keep it quiet. You know, apparently he was fighting cancer for like 6 years.
Yeah.
Who, right? And it just goes to show that it's only public if you want to make it public.
Well, exactly.
You know what I mean? Like, apparently it was a private battle. He didn't want anybody, you know, and good for him. You know, good for him that, you know, he wasn't out there like as a spectacle for everyone to see as he got sicker and sicker, you know?
Yeah, and I can't blame him.
Not at all.
Oh, jeez.
But yeah, I met him at a fan convention a long time ago. And
as Paul Rubens, because we refer to him as Pee Wee Herman. But
yeah, no, well, as Paul Rubens, but he was wearing the jacket and the bow tie, you know.
Yeah, I guess he kind of has to.
I mean, he leaned into it, you know, but he didn't make, you know, he didn't talk in the voice or anything like that. He was just a normal dude. But he was very nice. And granted, you have to look at that through the filter of, he's at a fan convention, so, you know, but by all accounts, like, I know other people who met him just by chance, and he always was very nice and accommodating to take a picture or sign something, you know. Seemed to be pretty nice guy. I did like him in, and I have a special affinity for that movie Mystery Men.
Yeah,
you remember that, like all the oddball superheroes. His character name was the Spleen, and I just never, I can't even say it now without laughing, you know?
It's funny. That's funny.
Yeah. So, yeah. So I just, like I said, I have an affinity for that movie. I find it very, very entertaining. But yeah, that's too bad, you know? And it just goes to show, you know, like, that was one of those deaths that really lit up my social media.
Oh,
you know,
yeah,
it blew up. It part of a lot of our childhood, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Kiwi's, well, you
Playhouse.
Know, and, you know, that was well past my childhood. But Kiwi's Playhouse was simply one of those things that transcended age.
Well, especially since it, you know, like a lot of those type of shows, it was very subversive and had a lot of jokes that would go over kids' head. Like, my daughter is into all this shit now. And not too long ago, she's like, Dad, what? I just discovered Pee-wee's Playhouse. Why didn't you tell me about this sooner? And I'm like, well, I figured you'd come across it on your own, you know? And
yeah.
She's like, man, did you let me watch this when I was a kid? And I said, well, you weren't, you know, you were not born, you know, you know, this wasn't a thing when you were a kid. So no, I didn't show it to you, but there's definitely a lot of jokes that would have gone over your head as a kid, you know? And then I told her to watch Pee-wee's Big Adventure. I don't know if she's done it yet.
Yeah, and something else to remember about Pee-wee's Playhouse is it has some people who came on who came to be very notable, like Lawrence Fishburne, Phil Hartman.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And, well, this name won't ring a bell immediately. Well, it might for you. S. Apatha Murkison from...
Oh, Baltimore. Okay, of course, yep.
Yeah. Yep. So there were a lot of well-known people who were on that show.
Yeah, 100%.
And it was imaginative. It was like an acid trip for kids.
Oh, dude, it's an acid trip now.
Yeah.
I did not know, so I'm reading about Pee-wee's Playhouse now. Paul Rubens was the voice of the ship's computer in Flight of the Navigator.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Did not know that. Huh. Little things.
Yeah. Cool. We will miss you, now,
Pee-wee. Yeah, rest in peace, man. So, the couple other notable ones.
Yeah, I had to look that up, and then I saw who they were, and I'm like, yeah. How the fuck did I gotten that?
So, Sinead O'Connor.
Yes.
Now, I appreciated her and her voice and her music. Wasn't necessarily the biggest fan, but there was a period of time in music where she was everywhere. You know?
Oh, yeah. You know, Nothing Compares to You. Probably one of the greatest songs from the late 80s, early 90s. I forget specifically when it came out. But, I mean, that is a genre-defying classic. You know, and it was written by Prince, and I know Prince has recorded it on his own, and then it was originally recorded by a side band type project that he had. But it wasn't until Sinead O'Connor recorded it and made it her own that it charted or did anything. And I watched the video the day that she died, and I'd forgotten just how good and simple that video is and how beautiful the song is and such an amazing voice. I had all of her albums. I was a fan. I was a big fan of hers. And, you know, 56, I didn't realize she was a couple of years younger than I am. And they didn't say what the cause of death was, but I'm assuming it was probably self-inflicted.
Yeah, that's kind of the prevailing thinking, you know. She was definitely troubled, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't even, like, so when people, I've read some articles and some social media posts and stuff about her. So when people say she was troubled, they refer to, like, her ripping up the photo of the Pope, you know, quite the real enemy. I just think that that's a political statement. I don't think that has anything to do with being troubled. I mean, I think a lot of people felt that way during the conflict in Northern Ireland, you know?
Yeah.
So
but look how right she was.
Right. Right. Yeah. Right. So I don't, that personally, I remember it as, you know, the big scandal at the time, but it didn't bother me at all. I'm like, all right, well, it certainly doesn't, you know. I guess my point is, I think it's wrong now, like, for people to reflect on that and say, well, we should have known she had mental illness, you know, like,
no, yeah, that was a statement. That was an act.
100%. And music has always been connected to political activism, you know, Joan Baez, you know, Arlo Guthrie, you know, Bob Dylan, right? Like, so are we going to start, like, I mean, they all might be crazy. I don't know. But
yeah, and even still, bands that aren't political have had, you know, somewhat political songs.
Of course.
You know, Genesis had Land of Confusion.
Yeah.
And then they had, and they really should probably have never recorded this song, Illegal Alien.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If you watch the video for that,
huh.
It's like, what the? And it's hard not to look at a video like that with today's sensibilities.
Yeah, that's true.
It really is. But even then, I remember seeing it when it first aired on MTV thinking, well, that's certainly out of the blue. but, you know, everybody, you know, Bruce Springsteen's had political songs. So, you know, the two go hand in hand almost. You know, and rock and roll itself really is just a political act in and of itself. It's, you know, it's very anti-conformist. And that's why people hated it. It wasn't the music itself. It's what it stood for. You know. So, you know, I hope she's found peace. You know, I don't know what happens after we pass, but I hope, you know, she's got some kind of closure. I know her son committed suicide about a year ago.
Yeah, 2022. Yeah.
You know, and that has to affect somebody greatly. So I couldn't imagine what she was going through with that. So I just hope she's at peace now.
Yeah. Yeah, that was one. I mean, I hadn't really thought about her in a while, you know, to be honest with you. I mean, I wasn't like such a big fan that I followed her career later in life. But yeah, you know, that one was sad. You know, like I said, might not have been a fan, but I certainly had no issue with her, you know.
Yeah.
And yeah, she was a huge, huge star for a long time. So speaking of huge stars, Tony Bennett.
Yeah.
Now here's one. He was in his late 90s. He was 96, so he had a good run, you know.
Well, absolutely, and he was active up until just a couple of years ago.
Oh yeah,
because you know, the last concert that he did, I believe, was at Radio City in New York with Lady Gaga.
Mm-hmm.
And their friendship still baffles me to this day. You know, how the fuck did those two get together in the first place?
Yeah, you know, but I also found it like adorable.
I did too.
They just genuinely liked each other.
Yeah.
You know,
they absolutely did.
And I was glad that they recorded that concert, you know, at Radio City. So that I was able to watch it, you know, cause I didn't go. So yeah, that was sad. I mean, even when you have Frank Sinatra at one point saying that Tony Bennett was the greatest American singer at the time, that's saying something.
Yeah.
You know,
and he was another one who was fairly, private. You didn't hear a lot about him. He wasn't in the tabloids. You know, he was generally well liked by everybody. I've never heard a bad thing about him. So he was just an all around good guy, and you know, the kind of voice that we may never hear again.
Yeah, 100%. And so I think I mentioned this on the show a long time ago, but when I was working in retail, I was a store manager, and our store was across the hall in the mall from some art gallery, some art store. And they had him in there one time. They had a few pieces, you know, I don't know if they were originals or just, you know, prints or whatever, but he was there at the store, you know. And at one point it was a little slow. So I walked over and I just said, "Oh, Mr. Bennett, I just wanted to say hello. You know, I'm going to be completely honest. I'm not an art collector or anything," I said, "but your music, you know, has, you know, my grandmother, my parents, you know, and I learned an appreciation for the classics, you know." And he said, "So thank you for that." And he was very, very nice. Unfortunately, this is long before cell phones or anything. Yeah. I don't have a picture or anything like that. But he was a super, super nice guy. People forget about that he was a fairly successful painter.
Yeah.
You know, and he had art showings all over the world. So.
One other quick one that I want to mention. And it was Julian Sands, because I don't know if we talked about him or not.
I don't think we did.
He kind of fell through the cracks.
Yeah. But
he went missing several months ago, and because apparently he was an avid hiker, and he went missing, and they finally found his body just a few weeks ago in around the area where he had supposedly been hiking. And he was in his 70s, too.
No, actually, 65. I'm looking at it here.
I've been a huge fan of his ever since I saw A Room with a View. He was absolutely one of the most beautiful people I've ever seen in my life in A Room with a View. And he was so good in that. That is such a good movie. Those Merchant Ivory movies that they did in the 80s, you know, I know a lot of people could take or leave them, but I absolutely love those E.M. Foster adaptations that they did. Some of the best adaptations of any kind of books I've ever seen. And A Room with a View was certainly no exception. And but he just took my breath away. But he was so good at that that I just followed him as well, you know, as best as you could pre-internet.
Sure, sure.
And then I saw him in Warlock, you know, which made me fall in love with him even more as an actor, because that was such a good, well, not a great movie, but it was a really good
movie. It's an entertaining movie. I like it. The sequels got a little dodgy, as sequels often do.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, I like Warlock. So that one, I didn't, when it was reported that he went missing, I didn't do like a deep dive or anything, but I'm like, okay, you're fairly, you have some notoriety, you're a well-known actor, like you're going to go on a hike, like up in the mountains or whatever. Don't you have like a buddy? Like, don't you go with another person? You know?
Well, you should. You really should.
I mean, I don't know many of the details, but a month in, right, when they said, oh, he's still missing. And I'm like, yeah, no, we're not going to find him unless he got abducted by aliens.
Yeah.
Or, you know, he really just decided to make himself disappear.
And really at that point in his career, it's not like he was, you know, really in demand for anything.
Not really. Like, I'm looking at his credits. He had like some various minor roles throughout the year, you know.
He was in one of my favorite Stephen King miniseries on made for TV, Rose Red.
You know, I don't think I ever saw that.
Oh, it's a good one. It's basically, you know, a haunted house in Seattle.
Yeah, no, I am familiar with the work. I don't think I've ever seen the show.
It's worth watching. It's worth watching. I really enjoyed it.
Huh. I have been looking for my next thing to watch, and maybe that will be it.
You may have found it.
Because I finished binge watching The X-Files, finally. Got all the way to the end. And my
that took longer than the original series took.
Yes. My original assessment remains. It was a great show, but it got way too lost in the overarching mythology of the alien invasion and the conspiracy and everything. Yeah, and I just couldn't. I'm like, I don't want to have to work this hard to watch a goddamn television show. You know, like, how the cigarette smoking man died, but didn't really die about 47 times.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
And it's like, you know, a helicopter fires a rocket into the place where he is, but he survived somehow. I'm like, come on, you know, enough with this. I thought the revival that they tried in the middle of last decade was pretty good.
Yeah,
I thought Gillian Anderson just gets freaking hotter with age. I mean, oh my God. I mean, seriously, you know, but even then it was like, oh, can we please move on? Like, with this, can we please wrap up this alien invasion shit? You know, like there are some classic Monster of the Week episodes that are so, so good. You know?
Oh, absolutely.
But then I'm just like, oh, enough. Like this fucking cigarette smoking guy. He was recently at a X-Files convention and I wanted to go, but I couldn't make it. I wanted to just walk up to his table and say, will you just effing die already? You know? Oh my God. You know, but he was a good villain.
He was. He really was.
So cool and cold and calculating. Like, and he was one of those villains that truly believed in what he was doing.
Yeah.
That's what made him so scary, you know? And just the way he just was like, you know. Oh, and I would like to point out that in the very final season, Mulder kills like 50 people. You know? Yeah. So the series wraps up with him and Scott. And I'm like, okay, do we get to see him go on trial for murder, you know, or what? Like, okay, Scully's pregnant again, ostensibly with his baby, but he's never going to see that kid because he's going to jail for like 10,000 years.
Yeah, he gets special dispensation to do that from Skinner, no doubt.
I guess so, but spoiler alert. Even Skinner dies at the end. So,
yeah.
But again, like to as far as anybody else knows, those agents that were chasing them were just government agents, and yeah. He killed all of them. You know, so I'm guessing you don't get to walk that off.
Yeah, that's gonna call for more than just a write up in your file.
Yeah, like a paragraph in your fucking report, you know. So there's one more death. A lot of people seem to know who this guy was, but I did not. Angus Cloud from some show Euphoria.
I know the show, but
he was only 25, which sucks apparently. Yeah. You know, cause of death unknown. Best known for playing drug dealer Fezco O'Neill in Euphoria. I had not even heard of that show.
I've heard of the show.
Just not familiar. But it doesn't look like I'm the target audience for it. So
no, I think it's about a high school.
Yeah, Emmy Award winning teen drama series. So yeah, definitely not. Definitely not my wheelhouse.
Yeah, same here.
But that sucks. You know, he's only 25.
Yeah, 25 is really
currently an active investigation. So who knows? Huh. Yeah, man. Like I said, a lot of it, we're of an age where all of our heroes are getting old. I wonder what kind of world we're going to leave for Keith Richards.
Yeah, right. Mick Jagger celebrated his 80th birthday not that long ago, like a couple of weeks ago.
Jesus Christ.
And he hasn't changed all that much, you know?
No. Yeah, look at that. July 26th, turned 80 years old.
I just can't fathom when I hear something like that. I can't. You know, and Peter Gabriel turned, I think it was 73. And you know, and he's been out on tour for, you know, promoting his new album that's supposed to come out sometime between now and when Hell Freeze is over. and I've seen clips and stuff of the tour online on YouTube. And, you know, that man, you know, still sounds the same as he did on his first album.
Yeah, he does. Right? He does sound good.
And he still plays Salisbury Hill in the same key as he recorded it in 40 years ago. How many fucking singers can say that?
No one.
Yeah.
No one.
Yeah.
That's why, like, even like Robert Plant did a very, very smart thing when, you know, whenever he does perform, like, so he'll go out on tour mostly with Alison Krauss these days, but he'll perform some Led Zeppelin songs or from solo songs, but he definitely tuned it down a couple of notches, you know, and yeah. Wisely so, you know, because people want to still hear the songs, but they don't want to hear them butchered beyond recognition, you know.
Well, absolutely.
So if you can't hit the notes, cool, just recognize.
Yeah, yeah. So it's sad to watch, as you said, watching our lives just die before our eyes and knowing that we're next on the chopping block at some point.
So
all right, so let's talk about the Exorcist clip first. So the guy who did, and I can't remember his name, Brian Green something or other, who did the Halloween movies?
The director, you mean?
Yeah.
David Gordon Green.
David Gordon Green. Well, I was close.
Yeah, close. Yeah, the Green.
Yeah. You know, he's doing a, I guess it's a sequel to The Exorcist.
Yes, it's supposedly a direct sequel to the original 1973 film.
And I know we've talked about this before. I know we talked about it when news first broke that it was being made. And when I found out that it was him who was directing it, because I'm not a fan of these most recent Halloween movies by any stretch of the imagination, I was a bit disappointed. And I was not having a whole lot of high hope for it, even with Ellen Burstyn in it. But I will tell you, after watching the preview for it, that trailer kicked ass. I absolutely dug that trailer. Now, my criticism of it is when it first starts, it could be, you know, any Blumhouse movie.
Right.
Any A24. Well, no, not A24. They do really good stuff. But definitely a Blumhouse movie or a Platinum Sands movie or whatever that Michael Bay company is. But once you hear the first few little tinkles of bells from Tubular Bells.
Yep.
And once you let your erection subside from hearing that, it's good. And they're going in an interesting direction with having two kids being possessed. One black and one white. And I'm just finding it interesting how they're going to do that and what kind of heavy subtext there's going to be in there. Because they wouldn't have done that if they didn't have something to say about it, I'm sure.
Yeah, I agree. Like, so you know me, we've talked about this so many times. I am not as militant about sequels and remakes and such as a lot of people are. To me, it's like any other film. It'll either be good or it won't. Yeah. And let's face it, a lot of times we are pleasantly surprised. You know,
absolutely.
I liked the Evil Dead remake. You know, I liked the Hills Have Eyes remake. You know, The Exorcist does hold a special place in my heart. But then when they said, well, this is going to be a direct sequel, I'm like, okay, I feel better about it now rather than say, oh, let's do like a shot for shot remake.
Yeah.
And yeah, I like the trailer, man. It looks good. I'm just, you know, I'm hoping it has like that same real creepy vibe as the original. I think it is cool that Ellen Burstyn is in it when she says, I'm going to paraphrase the line, when she says something like, I've seen this before. I'm like, yeah. Oh, yes, you have.
and they can see the picture of Regan from the mobile. Yep.
Yeah.
That gave me goosebumps when I saw that.
Yeah. And you're right. When they give little, like a few notes of Tubular Bells, and then towards the end of the trailer, like it hits in full. And I'm like, I'm in. When does this movie open? October 13th. I'm in. I'm there. Exactly. You know, even my daughter, because it's funny, I love looking at things through her lens. And over the last couple of years, we've gotten caught up on a lot of my favorite horror movies, Jaws, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Exorcist. She is not really fazed by them. Like with, like in The Exorcist, you know, she's like, yeah, well, it was okay. And I'm like, get out of my house. But like, you know, like now certain things, like she does agree, like were shocking, like the crucifix masturbation scene. She's like, holy shit, Dad, they did that? And I'm like, yeah. I'm like, yeah, sure did. You know? But, you know, but it's just because these kids have just, there's nothing they haven't seen.
Yeah.
You know, they're watching things on their phone that I'm just like, oh my God, I can't believe you watched that. You know? So, but even she's excited for it. She's like, Dad, we got to go see, like, you got to come, you know, and we got to get together to go see Exorcist. So,
yeah,
I'm excited for it.
I am too. And I think when you look at The Exorcist now, watch it now, and I actually watch it once or twice a year.
Me too. I watch it fairly regularly.
I really do enjoy it. And talking about it now makes me want to watch it again. Mm. It's tame somewhat. And I know somebody's going to remember me saying this about Halloween. And they're going to say, well, you said the first hour of Halloween was a snooze fest. And nothing happens in The Exorcist for the first hour. And you're right, but these were actually interesting characters, you know. Ellen Burstyn's character was very interesting. The priest had a very interesting story that we followed throughout the whole film. Sure. And I loved the detective in it, always trying to get somebody to go to a movie with them.
Right?
There's a lot of character building. And in Halloween, they wasn't, you know. But when, you know, you start to realize that there's something going on as far as Regan being possessed, you know, that's when it takes off. You know, the first time she goes in and sees the bed bouncing up and down, you know, that's when the whole movie just takes off for the most part. And it has more of an impact because we've come to know those characters. And I've said this forever, and I try and do this in my books as much as I can. In order for the fantastical elements of a movie or a book or whatever to work, you have to have it grounded in reality. That is why Stephen King is so successful. I mean, yes, he's a great writer, but he's a great writer because he creates believable scenarios and believable characters. And when you have that at the start, then you can take the audience anywhere you want them to, and they'll believe it. And that's what happened with The Exorcist. And that actually is something we're going to talk about when we talk about The Flesh, too. But specifically with The Exorcist, as I said, it's just all character building that first hour. And I just found that riveting as a drama because it has that very 70s, almost made for TV movie drama feel to it.
Yeah. And there's when it came out again in theaters some years ago when it was branded the version you've never seen, because it had like the missing footage, including the spider walk and everything. After the movie, no, or before, one or the other, I don't remember, they showed that there's a documentary about the making of The Exorcist and like all the stuff that William Friedkin did to give it that illusion, you know, of reality. You know, when you see, when they're in the bedroom and you can see their breath, it's because he was actually pumping cold air into the room to make everybody uncomfortable. And Ellen Burstyn had back problems for a long time because that scene where she gets jerked backwards, they had her in a harness and everything, but she did not know when it was going to happen. So when they pull her backwards, that's a genuine reaction on her part, you know, of shock. So yeah, William Friedkin really messed everybody up to make that movie, you know, and it comes across on screen because everybody is just freaking uncomfortable the whole time, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, and to a certain extent, you almost had to do it that way. Well, you did have to do it that way back then because there was no CGI. Everything was real. So you had to do things like that. I remember seeing in documentaries about the original Alien, you know, the chest bursting scene. Nobody was knew what was going to happen. So when the thing pops out, you know, that look of surprise and shock and disgust on everybody's face was real because they didn't know that was going to happen.
Yeah.
And I love that that happened. That couldn't happen today, I don't think. People get all pissed off and say that it was all some kind of an assault or something like that. But, you know, practical effects, man, I love them. I love the CGI because it's gotten a lot better for the most part. But nothing beats having to be creative in creating some of the stuff that you see in The Exorcist or Jaws or whatever.
Oh, definitely, man. There's no question about that. And, you know, and there are so many stories about things like that where people didn't know what was going to happen to them. Susan Backlini, who played the first victim of the shark in Jaws, the skinny dipping girl. Same thing. Like they had her in a harness where they were pulling her back and forth and she didn't know exactly what was going to happen. And in later years, she said that she had back problems for basically forever because of that, you know?
Oh, wow.
I guess it's called suffering for your art, but I wouldn't know. The worst that I had was a pipe to the skull.
Yeah. So, and you know, that's just a typical Friday night.
Yeah, so. Exactly. That, you know, so it was, and that was only mildly uncomfortable. So, all right. So we have some time. Do you want to, we do have time left if you want to talk about The Flash.
Yeah. Well, the Flash is now on streaming, or, you know, video on demand, I guess I should say. So when I saw that it was on, I had to watch because I wanted to see the movie anyway. And I do like Ezra Miller as an actor. So I thought, well, now's the perfect time to watch it. And so I did. And I liked it a lot. I didn't find the characters that he played, you know, two versions of himself, to be all that annoying as you did. He's certainly no more annoying as a teenager than what Peter Parker was.
Oh my God, come on. Ezra Miller is doing basically a 2 hour long Justin Long impression.
but I dug the character. Yeah, is some of the CGI dodgy? Yeah, it is. Particularly when they're going through the multiverses towards the end and they're going through the different times.
And let's not to mention the babies in the beginning. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Like that. Well, that leads me into something that I want to talk about just a little bit.
Is this going to be a PSA how you really shouldn't put a baby in a microwave?
No, I was
kind of know that.
No, I was hoping they would turn it on. You know. They would have
you crazy bastard.
They would have in a trauma movie.
That's true.
But one, as I said earlier, when talking about The Exorcist, one of the reasons it works so well is because they create that sense of believability in the first hour or so of the movie. Comic book movies have gone from being movies based on comics to almost live action cartoons. And a lot of what made comic book movies work in the past don't work anymore because you still you have to suspend your disbelief much more than you had to. Like with the last two Avengers movies, the Endgame movies. And the Guardians of the Galaxy movies. Don't get me wrong, I enjoy them. I love the Marvel movies, but they just got bigger and louder and more reliant on cartoon style storytelling as opposed to continuing to base it on comic books, which they didn't always have a basis in reality, but a lot of times they did. And it just gets to a point where you're like, enough is enough. And I think that's one of the reasons why superhero movies just aren't doing as well. The burnout, number one, but they just don't have that charm that they used to have. And having said that, there was a lot that I liked about The Flash. I enjoyed it. I loved seeing Michael Keaton's Batman again. I absolutely did. I thought every scene that he was in, he stole the movie from everybody else. I loved seeing the nods to George Reeves and to Christopher Reeve. And I absolutely loved the Nicolas Cage cameo.
Yeah, but Superman. But Scott, who cares? It was so pointless. Like, all those characters are just CGI people standing there doing nothing when the most important thing about that whole scene is the two Barrys, the disagreement about what to do next. And the one Barry is like, we have to let it go. We have to let mom die. Like, that's the conflict of the movie. Oh, look, Adam West's Batman in the background. Yay. Ultimately, it was all pointless. It was for nothing other than to say, oh, look, Nicolas Cage. What did the character do that it made it such a great cameo? Nothing. He stood there. Nothing.
Well, it's not about, him doing anything in the cameo. It was a good point of... what's the word I'm looking for? It was a good point of reference to show how each time they tried to bring the mother back and something different happened, you see a different version of, a superhero. Now, I think they probably should have stuck to all of the different Batmans, because God knows there's enough of them, rather than using Superman. But it was still a point of reference. Of the different ages and what was happening every time they tried to bring the mother back. And I thought it worked. As I said, I think probably it should have been all Batman or even, not even Supergirl, but just Batman. And and the whole Supergirl thing, that part could have been cut out. She added nothing really to it. No. But I understand they needed somebody to save the day at the end, and I guess, Supergirl was it. I enjoyed it. I don't go into these movies expecting anything anymore, because the mystique of them is long since gone.
Well, yeah, and look, obviously, Scott, people like what they like, and you know, we can have some good-natured ribbing, you know, but you liked it, okay, you liked it. I don't see what was to like, but okay. But that logic though is like saying, well, I'm standing in a smaller pile of shit, so I guess that's a positive, you know, like to say, well, superhero movies, the bar is so low now that if I get some enjoyment out of a movie, I guess that's okay.
And it's not even that the bar is so low now, because really it's not, you know, it's, they keep trying to top each other with the next movie, and they can't. DC in particular has that problem.
Yeah, this is true.
Marvel doesn't seem to have that issue. But as I said, Marvel has gone from comic book to cartoon. And that kind of ruins the Marvel movies anymore. Because you don't have that basis in reality. And I think that's one of the things that was a big plus for The Flash was the, you know, the human elements, you know, of, you know, Barry losing his mother. And,
yeah.
You know, that, I mean, because, you know, we've both lost, you know, our mothers. And I think both of us would do anything we could to try to bring them back if it were possible. So, you understand. Well, aside from burying them in a pet cemetery, I suppose that probably would be. But you empathize, even if you may not want to do it yourself. You empathize with his feelings, and that's the human element that I thought brought everything that happened after that together. And I went with it because I understood the feeling, and I thought Ezra Miller did a fantastic job. You know, you don't like the character, I do. I liked both of the characters, and I liked that there was going to be conflict between the two of them. I figured that was going to happen because you need to have some kind of conflict in a movie. And I liked how they finally, you know, got to the same page, as it were. And well, I just, you know, there was a lot that I liked about it. You know, and you're right. We like what we like. And I'm making no excuses. I like The Flash, and I watched it twice, and I'll watch it again.
Here's my problem. So I agree with you about the central conflict, right? That's the whole emotional heart of the movie. But I guess from the get-go, I was like, are we really doing the Flashpoint paradox again? It's been done so many times. They just did it on the Flash TV show. The exact same thing. Barry goes back in time to stop his mother from getting killed, and it fucks up the whole timeline. So I was a little disappointed that they were rehashing. This story has been told multiple times in the DC universe. So I'm like, oh, well, I guess we're doing it again.
All right. You say that, but I've never watched the Flash TV show. I've never read the comics. This was the first time that I've seen that particular story arc. And so I'm sure that if that's true for me, who's, you okay. know, a nerd.
Okay, you know, I'll give you that. I'll give you that. That's fair. I'll give you that. For me, I guess it was a little different because I had experienced all those other retellings. So, okay, fair point. I stand corrected. So here's the thing. Like, the whole movie is about Barry realizing the mistake he made, and sometimes you have to let things go. And now it's about how do I fix it? But then he doesn't. He ends up changing the timeline anyway when he fixes the video, right? So that his father gets exonerated. And then the movie just ends. So the whole point was we just have to let things go. When we try to change it, it messes everything up. Oh, but look, I'm going to change things anyway. And you know, and I'm like, so then what was the last 2 hours about?
Well, I think that probably was a setup for a second Flash movie, which I don't think they'll be making now. Which is unfortunate because I wouldn't mind seeing a sequel to this.
Well, there's no way that's going to happen because it lost a gazillion dollars, you know?
Yeah.
So at some point, DC is going to have to pump the brakes and say, can we course correct? Like, how do we right this ship, you know?
Yeah.
And you're not the only person that said they liked it. The problem is there wasn't enough of you, right? You know, the overall response was on the negative side.
Yeah.
Hence the fact that it didn't make money, just like other movies. You know, there's other movies that flopped as well. Indiana Jones was a loser for Disney, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't think we'll be, I don't know what DC is going to do. I know Aquaman, there's another Aquaman coming out. And who knows, like their best one, right? So Wonder Woman, I felt, was like their best one. The first Wonder Woman was so good. They dicked up the second one, but salvageable, right? People like the character, just get a better writing team. And I have heard nothing about another Wonder Woman movie, you know?
Yeah.
She has like a 2-second cameo in The Flash, just to make Batman look like an idiot. And then that's it. So who knows, man? I agree with you wholeheartedly on one thing, though. I personally was burned out on superheroes. After Endgame, I didn't really watch many of the TV shows. I did not watch Hawkeye. I did not watch Loki. I didn't watch Secret Invasion. I'm just like, oh, I've had enough. You know, just had enough.
Yeah, well, and I don't watch any of the superhero TV shows. I like the movies, but I just don't want to be invested in a weekly show when it comes to superhero stuff. Because
yeah,
they just get repetitive. And I love the old Batman series and the old Superman series. But, you know, really, it was just the same thing week after week. You know, and that may be different with superhero TV shows today. I don't know, but I just don't feel like investing the time and energy in watching them at this point.
Yeah, I get that. Some of them are good. I thought WandaVision was really good. I have some problems with some of the story. But again, after a while, it was just too much.
Yeah.
You know, like I like pancakes, but I wouldn't eat pancakes 3 meals a day, every day, you know?
Oh, of course you would.
All right, who are we kidding? I probably would. But one day I might put cinnamon and sugar, and the next day I might put syrup. So.
All right, fair enough.
All right. And just like that, we're out of time.
Okay.
Once again. So,
what have you got going on?
Oh, my God. So, well, right now I am busy getting my daughter ready for college. Classes start in less than 3 weeks. I'm moving her into her apartment in a couple of days. And I just got the first tuition bill. So
lucky it's you.
My Venmo is, you know, time to start a GoFundMe. But, you know, so that's really it, man. I didn't get a chance to talk about it yet, but on the next show. A couple of weeks ago, there was a small horror convention in New York called Catastrophic Con. That was pretty good for a first time, kind of second, you know, a smaller local convention. So I'll talk about that some more. I did do a bunch of cool interviews there. Saw our friend Beatrice Bupley, which was cool.
We need to have her back on soon.
We do. I'll reach out to her. And although she has her own podcast now, so she might be too good for us. Then again, everyone is too good for us.
Yeah.
So who are we kidding? But so that's really it, man. But I did, you know, start to get back. I went on my computer, started organizing all the scripts that I had started, you know, pulled them into final draft, which I finally purchased. So even if I just set a timer and do 20 minutes worth of writing a night, I got to get back into the swing of it, you know? So speaking of writing.
I get that. And the Tree of Everlasting Sorrow is going well, although I'm not sure if that's still going to be the actual title. That's what I'm using for right now. And with working and stuff, I was wondering how I was going to fit the writing in. And what I found is because I don't go in until the afternoon, I can write in the morning. And so that's what I've been doing. And I write 500 words a day on the days that I work. And then on the weekends, I try to do 1,000 words each day. And that's been my writing schedule, and that works. The only day that I don't write is the day that we record. Because I do need a bit of a break to recharge the brain every once in a while. But I've managed to do that since I started this book, and I've got, a little over 15,000 words right now, 15,021 words.
Nice.
And this is probably going to be as long as Errors of the Flesh, if not a little bit longer. There's some stuff that I think I'm probably going to end up cutting from the beginning of it because it's moving a little bit slow for me. But it's going, and I continue to do it each and every day. And you just have to sometimes sit your ass down and do it, even if it means getting up a half an hour earlier to get something done.
100%.
And it used to be that I thought, well, I've got to write 1,500 or 2,000 words, or otherwise I'm just slacking. And it's like, I write what I can write. If I try to give myself unrealistic goals, like 2,000 or 2,500 words a day, I'm never going to do it because I'm not going to look forward to sitting down to writing it. But doing little bite-sized chunks, like 500 words a day, and making a note of what I want to write the next day, that works for me. And so when I do the 1,000 words a day on the weekend, it's nothing. It takes me almost no time at all. I can knock out 500 words in about half an hour, 45 minutes, if I can keep myself off of OnlyFans or something.
Listen, you are one of my biggest patrons, so thank you for that. Before we wrap it up, I do want to give a quick shout out to some awesome people. So most people saw on my social media that last weekend, I went to see a special theatrical screening of The NeverEnding Story at Smodcastle Cinemas with Tammy Stronach, the Childlike Empress. And they had there a replica of the Falcor puppet, which was fucking awesome. Childhood wish fulfillment right there. So I took some cool photos with Falcor, but Falcor is owned by a store called Rascal Salvage Vintage. It's a store in Highbridge, New Jersey, that sells all kinds of like vintage toys and clothes and advertisements and posters and memorabilia. And they are really, really awesome. So please go to Rascal Salvage Vintage, one word altogether, .com to see their website. And then there you can find their Instagram and their Facebook and everything. Please check them out. They were the coolest people. And if you're into like old toys and trading cards and stuff, their shop is really cool. So I just wanted to make sure I gave a shout out to them. And Scott, we really need to have them on the show.
Well, get them on.
It would be a little bit of a departure, because they're not like filmmakers or something like that, but what they do is really cool. So wanted to just put that out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's get them on. We need to have a guest soon.
Yes.
So all right. And with that, until next time, may all of our journeys be filled with pure imagination.